From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. If you're a restorationist, you tend to view the past with affection and long for the world that once was. It's a concept that appeals to many political conservatives and to many religious groups, including the Mormons. In fact, the scholar Mark Silk says no American religious group has embraced the restorationist ideal more thoroughly than the Mormons. Silk says this orientation toward an idealized past has translated into political clout for LDS faithful, an interesting turn of events for a religion that has been historically scorned and oppressed. Today on the program, we're talking with Silk about why Mormons have become such a formidable Republican voting bloc. Plus, an artistic tribute to handiwork, celebration of the hand. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Mormons have been flexing their political muscle for decades, from the Equal Rights Amendment to California's Prop 8 to Mitt Romney's ascension as the GOP pick for president. But how did this once outsider religion become a player in national politics? Today on the program, we're talking about the rise of Mormon political influence and what a restorationist worldview has to do with it. Joining me on the program is Dr. Mark Silk. He is a professor of religion at Trinity College. He is also the editor of, the author of several books, including Spiritual Politics, Religion, and America Since World War II. He's delivering the opening lecture, Mormons and the New Political Restoration, at this year's Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, which is a gathering of Mormon intellectuals. That's happening this Wednesday night at 8 o'clock at the University of Utah. And Mark Silk is joining us via Skype from his home in Hartford, Connecticut. And Professor Silk, thanks so much for your time.
Delighted to be here, Jennifer, and I hope we can be on a first-name basis.
Indeed. Later on in the program, a new exhibit celebrates nimble fingers and opposable thumbs. But first, Mormons on the political stage. Why do you think Mormons have gained a seat at the head of the Republican table? Does the political side of the LDS faithful get in the way of religion? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Mark Silk, let's turn to your lecture on Wednesday. It's titled Mormons and the New Political Restorationism. First, what do you mean by political restorationism? What is restorationism?
Well, in the history of American religions, there are points at which, going back to the Puritans, but also to the foundation of the LDS Church, when groups have really wanted to restore the old ways, primitive Christianity for many of them, in the case of the Mormons, more than that. And one of the things that I'll be talking about is how the conservative movement over the past several decades has itself been very much devoted to the idea of restoring an old America. And this theme of restoring, I think, has deep roots in American religious history and especially in Mormon history.
Hmm. We will certainly get into the specifics of your thesis as we go. But, you know, you've been reporting and writing about religion in the news for many years now. Does it surprise you at all that a Mormon, Mitt Romney, is a presidential candidate for a major political party in 2012?
Well, you know, individuals are individuals. One could say, you know, it surprises me that an African American should be a serious contender for the presidency and get elected. But people aren't generic. They're individual. Obama is Obama, not just a black guy. And I think Mitt Romney is Mitt Romney and not just a Mormon guy. He obviously did have some hurdles to overcome, particularly in the Republican primary. And, you know, as you know, the first time around in 2008, he failed. And I was involved in running some numbers, which suggested pretty strongly that he would have won the nomination in 2008 had it not been for the reluctance of evangelical Protestants to vote for him in primaries. He managed to overcome that this year. And so now there he is, the Mormon candidate. But Mitt Romney would prefer to think of himself as simply the candidate who happens to be Mormon.
Hmm. In a 2009 article that you wrote in Religion in the News, you wrote, if Mitt Romney manages to capture the GOP nomination in 2012, he may have Proposition 8 to thank for it. What did you mean by that? What role do you think Prop 8 played in Mitt Romney's rise?
Well, I think what I had in mind there, always tough to be confronted with things that you wrote a few years ago, especially if they're about the present or the future. But I think what I had in mind was that the prominence of Mormon, really the LDS Church and of Mormons in fighting Proposition 8 in California, it seemed to me would go some ways towards assuring evangelicals, conservative Protestants who might be reluctant to vote for Mormon, that really Mormons were part of the grand coalition that they were associated with, and therefore, good people to have running the country. Whether that's really true or not, it's hard to say. But of course, the evidence of Mitt Romney's being the presumptive nominee of the party, all but certain, at least shows that I didn't make a horrible mistake.
Speaking with Mark Silk, he is director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, and he's a professor of religion at Trinity College. He's also the author of many articles and books, including Spiritual Politics, Religion, and America Since World War II. He's the founding editor of the magazine Religion in the News, and he also blogs for the Religion News Service. His column is called Spiritual Politics. He is the opening lecturer for the 2012 Sunstone Symposium being held this week in Salt Lake City. His lecture will be this Wednesday night at 8 o'clock in the Student Union Building at the University of Utah. It's free and open to the public. And we're talking about his subject matter, Mormons and the New Political Restorationism. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Mark Silk, what does faith-based voting look like today? I mean, is there a voting gap when it comes to religion?
Well, there is. One of the really interesting developments of the past couple of decades in American politics has been a division in the two parties on religious grounds, regardless of what your religion happens to be. These days, in a normal national election, and that would go for, overall congressional voting as well as in a presidential vote. If you ask people, and this is sort of with exit polls when they come out, do you attend worship services once a week or more? And then take those people who say yes and ask them how they voted. They will vote for the Republican by a margin of about 60% to 40%. That's a big gap. That's much bigger than the gender gap that we have been talking about for longer. And the gap goes the other way. If you say to people or the people who tell you they attend worship less than once a week or not at all, those people will prefer Democrats by a comparable margin. So we have that kind of religious partisanship in the country. Beyond that, different religious groups vote in quite different ways. And so we have Mormons, 3 out of 4 Mormons vote Republican, 3 out of 4 white evangelical Protestants vote Republican. Jews vote by a similar margin for Democrats. African American Protestants vote 90% for Democrats. Catholics are very divided, but within the Catholic community, which is very large, about 25% of the American population, white Catholics skew somewhat in a Republican direction, and Hispanic or Latino Catholics vote strongly Democratic. So that this kind of ethno-religious division in the population is quite striking, and also not, but not constant, as Mormons, old timers may remember. Mormons were not always as Republican as they used to, as they are now, and Catholics were much more Democratic than they are now. And so there's movement.
Is faith or religion affiliation, is that as determinative as your ethnicity or your economic class when you go to the polls? I mean, you were talking about combinations of, you know, African-American evangelicals. And I mean, does a religious affiliation supersede your tendencies to vote over a social class or an ethnic class?
It's an important question. And things don't look the same in every grouping. African Americans, for example, are actually slightly more likely to vote Democratic the more religious they are. And yet all African Americans are pretty much in the same boat. And you'd have to say that to a considerable degree, it's the African American experience which conditions their vote, and the close identification of the National Democratic Party with civil rights in the 1960s really moved the African American population that strongly into the Democratic camp. So there's that kind of thing. But overall, in the American population, religion is a pretty robust category. If you look at other possible demographic candidates, you can see some variation based on income, based on education, but religion is way up there, and not at all. Among all the factors, it's as robust as it gets.
And just to circle back to something you said, you know, the people in exit polls who say they don't have a religious affiliation, if you don't claim a religion, for those people, how large of a piece of the political pie are these no religion folks? What do they represent?
Well, the latest numbers that reported, or at least last week, in USA Today, from some Pew surveys, show that portion of the American population is now up to 19%. We call them, professor types, call them nuns, as in N-O-N-E-S, people who, when you ask them what is their religion, if any, will say none. And that's been a proportion of the population that's been growing. But interestingly, in terms of our conversation here, it's also become increasingly Democratic. If you go back to 1990, there was a slight preference or a modest preference for Democrats among these nuns, who were then around 7% of the population. But now the numbers are much more like 3-1, 75% of the no religion people vote Democratic, and it really bears testimony to this bifurcation, this division of the parties that I talked about.
Speaking with Mark Silk, he's director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, a professor of religion at Trinity College in Connecticut, and he is talking with us about a lecture he'll be presenting at the opening of the Sunstone Symposium this week, Mormons and the New Political Restorationism. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Back to this idea of restorationism, it sounds to me like a yearning for the past, a nostalgia for the world that what it used to be like as being better. What's the appeal for the Mormon audience in this particular line of thinking?
Well, the Mormon project, if you want to call it that, the beginning was profoundly about the business of restoring religion as it used to be. Prophecy had been dead, according to Joseph Smith, and it was revived in New York State. the whole idea of building temples, of reinstituting an older form of marriage, of creating a world. I mean, the whole idea of Latter-day Saints has to do with a restoration of religion as it used to be. Mormons are not the only restorationists around, but I think in the great scheme of American religion, they are foremost among the restorationists. And so the whole idea of restoring something that was a better thing that you're now bringing into existence again has been a very powerful one in American society generally, and one very strongly, important within Mormon culture. And so when you have a political movement, as the conservative movement, I argue, has been, which is as strongly restorationist as it's been since the era of Ronald Reagan, I think that has a kind of attractiveness to people in these religious traditions.
Speaking with Mark Silk, director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life and a professor of religion at Trinity College, he's presenting the lecture Mormons and the New Political Restorationism this Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. That's July 25th in the Student Union Building at the University of Utah. The lecture is free and open to the public as part of the annual Sunstone Symposium. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments for Mark Silk, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about Mormons, about politics, and how a restorationist worldview has contributed to the religion's alignment with the GOP. Joining me via Skype is Mark Silk. He's director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life and a professor of religion at Trinity College, author of many books and articles. He blogs for the Religion News Service, and he is presenting the opening lecture for this year's Sunstone Symposium titled Mormons and the New Political Restorationism. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Miriam has been joining us from Salt Lake City. Miriam, hi.
Good morning. I appreciate your comments, Mr. Silk, but there's some things I would really disagree with. First of all, I am a recent member of the LDS Church. I'm a Democrat. There are lots and lots of Utah Democrats, and they're coming out of the woodwork now. First of all, my position has always been religion should not be part of politics, period. I mean, that's not a requirement to be president. And that we, as people, make it a requirement is unconstitutional. And the second point is, for people who really understand the LDS religion, I don't see how anyone can be a Republican anymore. Because it's a religion about giving and loving and taking care of people. Along with many others, we are identifying ourselves as not a Romney Mormon, because him going to the extreme right, first of all, was not who he was when he was governor. And seeing things that he's saying about the vulnerable populations, about the programs that help people, goes against everything that's taught in the Book of Mormon, and certainly goes against everything that a lot of people, including Republicans, believe. I know we have a large number of, for lack of a better word, Tea Party Mormons, and certainly way too many of them in the legislature, but there's still a lot of reasonable, rational Republicans who aren't liking where he's going.
Miriam, I want to let Mark Silk get back in this conversation and get his response, but thanks very much for the call. Miriam brought up a number of points. Mark Silk, your thoughts?
Well, it is important always to realize that religious traditions, and especially sizable ones like the Mormon tradition, include a variety of people. And Miriam does reflect an important point of view. The fact is, however, that when you look at the numbers and you look at the voting patterns, and as she mentioned at the end, there the number of Tea Party supporters in the legislature and so on, you still end up with three out of four Mormons being strong Republicans, maybe some more moderate, maybe some less moderate. 25% of Mormons is still a large number, but it's not, as divisions in religious groupings go, Mormons remain very Republican and are more Republican now than they used to be. And maybe if there are more Miriams in the world, maybe more converts who feel the way she does, then that number will change because religions are always in motion.
Hmm. Miriam, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Speaking with Mark Silk about his upcoming lecture, Mormons and the New Political Restorationism, which is the opening lecture at the Sunstone Symposium this Wednesday night at 8 o'clock at the University of Utah. It's free and open to the public. Mark Silk, many Mormons believe that the Constitution was divinely inspired, that America is somehow sacred ground. Do other religious traditions share this vision of, America as an exceptional place, as playing out a mission from God?
I think it's fair to say that no religious tradition holds that to the degree that Mormonism does. That's not to say you can't find a lot of religious Americans of other traditions who don't feel strongly about, very strongly about America as a kind of divinely sanctioned or approved place, but their scriptures don't have that view built into them the way the Book of Mormon has it built into it, and the distinctively American character of the Mormon tradition, of the story it has to tell, and not only the story that the Book of Mormon has to tell, but the story of Mormons in America, a story of persecution, of an exodus to a promised land, to a building of a Zion. The narrative of Mormon history is itself a kind of sacred narrative, in a way that other religious traditions in America can't point to. It's not that there haven't been important religious events in America. There are saints that the Catholic Church has found active in America, but the fundamental narrative of the religion, both in its scriptures and in the experience of its people, have been tied to America in a way that I think is unparalleled in any other religious tradition that I know of. Somebody may call in and correct me, although I suspect not from Utah.
Mm. But is that the bridge that Mormons share with their conservative bedfellows? I mean, I'm thinking of Newt Gingrich and Pat Robertson. I mean, they all talk about America as in these, distinctly religious terms, as God-given rights and a land of that was created, divinely inspired by its founders to allow religion to flourish.
They do that, and you can certainly find people in the different religious traditions, and Judaism too, who credit the American system very, very substantially with setting the stage for for important religious developments, maybe even the coming of the millennium and so on. But you will also find people in those religious traditions who will be very critical of what they would call a kind of idolatry of America and so on, because the traditions are not so associated with North America. So I think, you know, it's you make an important point. One point that I would be inclined to make, and again, the connections have to be sort of ferreted out, but I think some of that kind of Mormon thinking about the sacred character of the Constitution and so on has actually fed into the larger conservative movement, sometimes in ways that are not always apparent. One of the right popular Mormon writers who's been publicized in recent years by Glenn Beck, Cleon Skousen, has not been publicized necessarily as a Mormon, but some of his ideas have gotten into the conservative mainstream nonetheless. And so I think it's an interesting story how ideas that come out of the Mormon tradition may have fed into the conservative movement without other conservatives quite realizing where they came from. Mm.
This email from Sammy, who writes, "A Mormon belief that the past was better is utterly detestable. Polygamy and doctrinal discrimination against minorities and homosexuals are things that the church would do good to distance itself from." I noticed that you've written, Mark Silk, about tensions within the Mormon tradition, you know, that change isn't always bad. And there have been among leaders, you know, this is, I don't want to call it a squabble, but certainly some divisions in, you know, what are improvements and what should have been, you know, that glorified past. Can you talk to Sammy's point here?
I think one of the strengths of a tradition that believes in ongoing prophecy is that new prophecies can come along which can improve on things. That's what prophets are about the business of doing, improving the situation. And I think the example of the way the LDS Church changed its views on race at the end of the 1970s and admitted African American men into the priesthood, I think most people would regard that as a big step forward. And so I'm not meaning to suggest here that the only object of a restorationist program is to go back to the past with all its warts. It's an interesting point. It's an important point that he makes there, and I think there are mixed feelings about many aspects of returning to the past. So I think I would not dissent from the point, but the fact remains that the kinds of things that restorationists have wanted to do in religion, to go back to an early church, to go back to a purer time, remains very important in the American tradition and in Mormonism in particular. Mm.
Speaking with Mark Silk, director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, he's a professor of religion at Trinity College, and he will be presenting the keynote address for this year's Sunstone Symposium, Mormons and the New Political Restorationism. That is happening this Wednesday, July 25th at 8 p.m. in the Student Union Building at the University of Utah. The lecture is free and open to the public. And if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments for Mark Silk about his argument, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. The Mormon experience, I mean, do voters care anymore? Are we over that already? Do you think that people will vote for or not vote for Mitt Romney based on religion alone, or maybe because of his restorationist politics?
I think it's, you know, one of the things that one can say with certain amount of confidence in American society is that the first candidate of a given group, and that's not only religious, but it might be racial or other, gets a huge amount of attention and support from that group. But then the second one, maybe not so much. So I think, you know, if you want to use a previous example from religion, John F. Kennedy drew a huge amount of support from Catholics. He was the first, he wasn't the first Catholic to run, but he became the first Catholic to be elected. In fact, the only Roman Catholic to have ever become elected president. But Catholics did not show similar kind of enthusiasm for John Kerry in 2004. And so it becomes, you know, less of a new thing. So I think Mitt Romney gets lots of Mormon support, maybe not from Miriam, but it's a big thing because this is a representative of our community. Whether the vote has to do with particular aspects of Mormon religion or not, it's an important communal statement. But perhaps the next Mormon presidential aspirant doesn't get the same kind of support.
Do you think that this issue matters, though, to Jews or Muslims or Catholic voters? I mean, is it going to be something that people think about when they go into the ballot box?
Probably different groups think about it in different ways. I think most Americans, it's not going to make much difference. Other issues make more difference. And you know, the economy, what your views on, you know, the whole range of let's say normal issues. The big question, I guess, you know, among, you know, for those Americans who are not Mormons, has to do with with evangelical Protestants who by the numbers disproportionately do have problems with the Mormon tradition, with Mormon beliefs. The evidence is that if you look at how people say they will vote, that evangelicals will vote for Mitt Romney, perhaps despite of his Mormonism, but nonetheless will do it. I think for the smart guys in the Republican or on, you know, in the political game, the question is not whether they will vote for President Obama, but whether out of some discomfort with voting for a Mormon will simply stay home. Turnout is a big part of all elections, particularly, of course, close ones. And if a lot of evangelicals stay at home rather than vote for a Mormon, then, you know, that's a problem for Mitt Romney. I think there's a sense that those evangelicals are sufficiently unhappy with President Obama that they will vote for Romney despite their misgivings. I think probably what concerns them is not the positions that they think a Romney presidency will take, but they became very attached to the idea of having someone like them in the White House during the presidency of George W. Bush. And I think at the back of their minds, there's this kind of unhappiness at the thought that apostles will be trooping to the White House and sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom, and in general giving a kind of prestige and you know of the presidency in the White House and of centrality to the American thing, to the LDS Church that they would prefer not to have. But whether that'll keep them at home, you know, we'll have to see.
Mark Silk, he is a professor of religion at Trinity College, director of the Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, and he is the keynote speaker for this year's Sunstone Symposium, which opens on Wednesday. His lecture, entitled Mormons and the New Political Restorationism, will be given at 8 o'clock in the Student Union Building at the University of Utah, and the lecture is free and open to the public. We'll have links on our website, kcpw.org. Mark Silk, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Well, I've been delighted to be here and enjoyed the conversation a lot, Jennifer.
Coming up next, celebration of the hand, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Hands. They allow humans to grasp, to pick up things, and to feel, and they're also extremely useful in the creative arts. Craft Lake City and the Temporary Museum of Permanent Change are paying tribute to handiwork in a new walkable outdoor exhibit. And today on the program, we're learning more about the gallery pieces in this exhibit titled Celebration of the Hand. Joining me in studio to talk about Celebration of the Hand, Angela Brown. She's editor and publisher of Slug Magazine and the festival director of Craft Lake City, Utah's Do-It-Yourself Festival, which opens in August. And Angela, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Kara Mia Pururi. She is the marketing coordinator for Craft Lake City. And Kara Mia, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having us here.
And again, the fourth annual Craft Lake City Festival will be held Saturday, August 11th at the Gallivan Center. We'll have links and more information on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about Celebration of the Hand, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Angela, this exhibit is part of the fourth annual Craft Lake City Festival. Before we get to that, describe the Celebration of the Hand exhibit. What's the concept?
Sure. So Stephen Goldsmith from the Temporary Museum of Permanent Change erected these placots several years ago around on the Broadway corridor of Salt Lake City from about 2nd West through 2nd East.
Okay. What's a placot?
A placot. It's basically the German word for billboard. And it's just a large steel frame that's about 9 feet.
9 by 7.
Yeah, 9 by 7. And usually it has community messages from other local nonprofits. And Carmia and I kind of came up with this concept about filling the placots with local artwork.
Okay. And why the hand, Carmia?
Well, when thinking about what we would actually put in there, because normally they're just used in a way to promote what's going on around the city. And so when we were looking at them and thinking, how could we utilize and take Craft Lake City artists and give them this piece to fill, and automatically it was, well, they would be filling it using their hands, and these were built, each frame, each placot was handmade. And so in that, the things that you see on the streets and the things that, the point behind the Temporary Museum of Permanent Change is celebrating the city. So it's a free museum, but it utilizes the city as its museum walls. So the placots are referred to as the windows of the museum. And the backdrop, or say the walls of the museum, are the cityscape, which was built by hands. So in kind of throwing around these ideas with Stephen, and just, it kind of just came out. It wasn't like, what should we name this? It almost was just one thing, one idea that we brought up was celebrating the hands, because the hands not only build our city, but they build Craft Lake. They build the pieces that we're wearing. They're, you know, all about local. And it just was sitting there on the paper, and it was like, well, I guess we're going to name this Celebration of the Hand, because it encompasses everything that we kind of stand for almost. Mm-hmm.
So again, if you are walking downtown Salt Lake City, you're on Broadway, and you see these little, they are kind of miniature billboards. They're right mm-hmm. on the sidewalk.
Correct.
Let's talk about some of the exhibit pieces. I'm looking at a couple on our website right now. This is one from Angela Flicker, titled What's Your Angle? Can you describe what this looks like visually?
Sure. And she's a textile artist, so she likes to use quilting as a medium to produce just these vibrant and beautiful works of art. And this is, I believe, one of the most colorful pieces that we've got on display for this exhibit. And hers is really fantastic because it's an interactive exhibit where she built these little pockets into the textile piece, where she's encouraging people from the public public to place items in there. It could be anything from a ticket stub to a movie that you just saw. I saw a couple business cards in them the other day. We put a couple of the Celebration of the Hand programs on opening night last Friday for people to pull those out and kind of have a guide to the walkable outdoor exhibit. But her piece is really stunning. And when you're just driving down Third South, it's in the parking lot kind of by Squatters and by Gracie's, and it just really pops, and it demands your attention.
Talking about the new exhibit, Celebration of the Hand, which is on display. Describe where it is. It's on Broadway between around
Second West and Second East is the way that I like to remember it, from the Rose Wagoner all the way up through KO Gallery and the Salt Lake Film Society.
This is sponsored by Craft Lake City. Angela Brown, editor and publisher of Slug Magazine and the festival director of Craft Lake, as well as Karamia Puriri. Sorry about that.
No,
marketing
fine.
Coordinator for Craft Lake City are in studio describing this for us. If you have questions or comments about Celebration of the Hand, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Another of your artists, Candace Jean, and her piece is titled Harriet the Hand Crafter. Karamia, can you describe that one for us?
Candace Jean is, her art is very... what is the word? Not so vintage, but Victorian-esque. And she has these girls that each represent something to her and something about what she's encountered. And Harriet the Handcrafter represents what, you know, what women are capable of. And it's not just about being a mommy homemaker. And, you know, Candace is a mom, but she's also a very talented artist. And, you know, she kind of doubles between being a mother and being a crafter and a creator, and pulls that into the community and, you know, welcomes that side of, it's not just about being, you know, one thing. You can be all these different things. And so her piece has Harriet is kind of in the middle, and then around are these hands holding up all these different tools that might be utilized when creating or when doing, you know, something, and they all represent something different. And so it's more of a representation of her and what the women in the community are capable of doing.
One of the hands is holding, as you might expect, a ball of yarn and some knitting needles. But others are a hammer, a wrench, a cupcake. it's really colorful, and it's really beautiful. How did you select the artists? I guess this is an exhibit featuring 11 or 12?
12, and it was a juried submission process where we invited some of the Craft Lake City participants from this year's festival to submit proposals. And then we went through them with Stephen and together narrowed it down, which was very difficult because we have so many talented artisans participating in Craft Lake this year. But, you know, this exhibit just really fit in line with our mission, because one of the things that we are working on with Craft Lake City is breaking down the term craft. You know, it's not just about the cool needlepoint that your grandmother used to make. It's about anything that's handmade. And like Karamia mentioned earlier, one of the missions of the Temporary Museum of Permanent Change is to talk about, you know, these cities that we live in. These were all hand-built. And I think there's this new appreciation with the whole DIY movement about going back and kind of recognizing things that are handcrafted, and just the power of how great it is to make something yourself.
Angela Brown, why did you feel the need to organize a festival centered on handicrafts, on artisanship, craftsmanship?
Well, besides it just being centered on craftsmanship, it's really a reflection of our community here. All of the artisans that participate are all from Utah. They're not all Salt Lake specific. They're the surrounding states as well. But I just felt like we really needed to bring attention to all of the talent that we have in Utah. And again, kind of getting that message about the power of creation and that empowerment that happens within yourself, and how good it can make you feel to make something and then either show it to your friends or the public, or sell it or vend it, or just create something useful that you can use in your everyday life. And it's about inspiration. It's about not only seeing what other people create, but also feeling the need yourself to create.
And Karamia, it's not just about knitting, needlepoint, those kinds of art would you call them art? I guess it is art. Yeah. Arts and crafts. But science and technology is also part of Craft Lake City.
Yeah.
How does that fold into this, the creative spirit that you're trying to showcase?
The DIY engineers, as we are calling them, are, it's a new category that we've kind of opened up, and we're welcoming the science and technology elements into Craft Lake City, because crafting and do-it-yourself isn't just about, you know, knitting a pair of socks or a hat or something.
Which is totally cool.
Yeah, which is really great. And we have some very talented knitters in our community who make beautiful pieces. But DIY engineers, we actually have some pretty hidden underground talented groups of people in Salt Lake who get together and create LED lighting displays and robotics and have robot wars on the down low, like no one knows about it. Or one group we've been working with closely is creating a 3D printer, which they're kind of new in the market, and they're being built like almost mass produced in a way. But when there is a group of people who is figuring out how to tinker with it and how to make it themselves, and they're putting in the pieces and each screw and each washer and this and that, and then watching it print is just, you know, how, like, you look at them and just like, how is this not DIY? Because they're creating these pieces that are interactive and, you know, almost in a way affect the community on, you know, on a, obviously a scientific standpoint. Like, this 3D printer is going to come in handy not just for them, but for everybody. And, you know, these robot wars are so cool to watch. Like, from, you know, being age 5 to being age 55 and 65, it's like, it's so entertaining. And there's people like this who are creating things all the time. And, you know, whether it's from robotics to solar powered pieces, or something that, you know, might help wash your dishes differently, or save air or energy a different way, they're handcrafted. They're, you know, the pieces might not be handmade. You can't make a solar panel yourself, or you can't make a robot piece yourself, but you can put it together. You can, you know, twist it into each other and control it through, you know, programming it. And so we want people to understand that there are these things going on in our community. And, you know, while they might be hidden, they are, you know, these are the people who program your computers during the day and who, you know, come up with different ways that make life and living easier for you. But they go home and their garage is full of just all these different things that you're like, where are these ideas coming from? And so we want to open that up. And X-Mission is actually bringing that element in with us. And so in the building, the new building at the Gallivan Center, it's the X-Mission Science and Technology building. And we'll be putting all of our tinkerers and our DIY engineers in there and just bringing in things that they create. Even if it's a program on a computer, it's still hand created. It's hand programmed. You know, it might be a little bit different to some people and to the true crafters who, you know, think that crafting is all about your hands. Programming like a video game or something like that is so, it's DIY down to, you know, to the T. So we want people to understand that. And I think bringing them in this year will really help open up a whole new meaning for DIY to the community. So
we're talking with Karamia Puri. She is the marketing coordinator for Craft Lake City. Also with us, Angela Brown, the editor and publisher of Slug Magazine, the festival director of Craft Lake City, which opens next month. And so this exhibit, Celebration of the Hand, these images on the placots downtown, that's really a nice introduction to the Craft Lake City Festival, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, right, Angela?
Yes, it is. And we're going to see how long these pieces do weather. We're hoping we can keep them up through August, through October of this year. And providing that the project works again, we've had some soft conversations with Stephen about curating them again. So we sure hope that we have that chance and are able to bring a whole new round of 12 Craft Lake City artisans either this fall or next spring for the public to check out as well.
And again, 12 artists participating in Celebration of the Hand. It's part of the 4th annual Craft Lake City Festival. We will have links on our website, kcpw.org. Angela Brown and Karamia Peruri, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and to our intern, Lauren Hendrickson. Coming up next time, we're taking off tomorrow for Pioneer Day. We're bringing you a special broadcast, an Intelligence Squared debate on fracking. So join us for that tomorrow. On Wednesday, we're back with a conversation with retired judge Tyrone Medley. So join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.